talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the birth of New York City as a centre of capitalism and pluralism and the myths that accompanied the invention of New York, the fall of civilizations and what we can learn from them, and to end the show, why Mary McSweeney opposed the treaty and how she was portrayed afterwards because of it. And we begin tonight's show with Taking Manhattan. In 1664, England decided to invade the Dutch-controlled city of New Amsterdam on Manhattan Island. Charles II and his brother, the Duke of York, had dreams of empire, and their arch-rivals, the Dutch, were in the way. And a new book reveals how the founding of New York was an invention, the result of creative negotiations that would blend the multi-ethnic capitalistic society of New Amsterdam with the power of the rising English Empire. The book is called Taking Manhattan, the extraordinary events that created New York and shaped America. It's published in hardback by W.W. Norton and Company. The author is Russell Shorto. And Russell, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Can I begin by asking you what drew you back to the story of New Amsterdam after your great success with The Island at the Center of the World?
Yeah, well, that book came out 20 years ago, and it was it told the story of what the Dutch did there before the English took over and named it New York. And I relied on a translation and publication project that has been going on since the 1970s when I wrote that first book, and that unearthed this 12,000 pages of material, the 17th century Dutch material that gave this backstory to what would become New York. I have always stayed connected to that translation work through the years. And in the past several years, I realized that as the project moved to encompass the last few years in the life of the Dutch colony, in the just before the English took over, that we were seeing New Amsterdam, this vibrant little sort of Wild West port city, in a way that the English would have seen it in 1664. So as this fruit that had ripened and was ready for picking, and I realized, okay, that in itself is a book which encompasses a more focused story. The first book was about the 40-year life of this colony. This book is really focused on a two-week period in the late summer of 1664, where you have the Dutch in their fort at the tip of the island, pointing their cannons out at these four English warships that are in the harbor, and they're pointing their cannons right back at them.
And an incredible 2 weeks it is. And from the way you're describing it, you would think that this is all going to lead to bloodshed and violence and destruction and a complete mess. But it's much more complicated and nuanced than that. And it's in a way more of a corporate takeover or a merger than a military conquest.
That's how I term it in the book. And yes, and that's the surprising thing. I mean, Richard Nichols, who sailed on behalf of Charles II and his brother, James, the Duke of York, came equipped for battle. He had 450 soldiers. His ships were packed to the gills with weapons and gunpowder. So he was ready to go. The Dutch were ready to defend. And during this two-week period, I mean, it really unfolds like a drama with several twists and turns at which one side or the other is about to say, okay, that's it, here we go, we're going to fight. And then one thing or another pulls them back down, lowers the temperature. And the story that I ultimately tell is one of recognizing the value of compromise, of nuance, of seeing things from the other person's point of view, and trying to work out a way in which we might both be able to win from this situation.
And Richard Nichols is a crucial figure in that. And you do see an incredible transition there. And do you think that the New York that emerges out of this very much reflects that compromise, reflects its origins, that in a way this is the story of how New York became New York.
That's exactly it. Because the Dutch laid the foundations in this 40-year period, they brought essentially two things. The Dutch pioneered tolerance, religious toleration, in the 16th and 17th century at a time when intolerance was pretty much official policy throughout Europe and also common sense. It was, you know, the standard thinking was it's a dangerous world out there and we have to be united to if we're going to survive as a city or as a society. So that means, and religion was the great divider. So having a state religion, things like that. The Dutch went in the other direction. They enshrined religious toleration as part of the foundation of their nation when it came to be. And they did that for a variety of reasons. One, they were the melting pot of Europe. They were the place, they were the Low Countries, of course, so people from other parts of Europe could flee to them if they were fleeing religious warfare, for example. But also the Dutch were seafarers, and they did business with people all over the world, and they knew the value of speaking other languages, and so they turned the prevailing wisdom on its head, and they made tolerance a key to their success. They also brought the building blocks of capitalism. While they were founding the society and founding their Dutch golden age, they invented the notion of a permanent corporation, of shares of stock, of a stock exchange. And so they brought all of these things. We put those two things together. That's kind of a recipe, not just for New York City, as I point out in the book, but ultimately because New York became as influential as it did, by extension, for American society. So that's that foundation. And then, as you say, the English come in, and through this merger, I think the English, Richard Nichols in particular, when he is pointing his guns at the Dutch fort, by this time he has learned a great deal about this place. He knows that it functions in this intriguing way, in a way that he doesn't quite grasp because it was something new. But he wants it. He wants to keep it. He doesn't just want this piece of real estate. So he's trying to figure out how can I appease them and, in fact, get this mixed group, because it was, you know, there were famously 18 languages being spoken there in New Amsterdam. How can I get this mixed group of traders who have trading networks in South America, in the Caribbean, and throughout Europe? How can I get them to stay and to be a part of this? And we will over time make it English. So that's the story that transpires and that ultimately happens and gives us New York, and among much else.
And it's great for so many people. It's great for history, but it's not great for the Native Americans.
Certainly. You know, I talk about Dutch tolerance. You have to limit that. You have to narrow what we're talking about. First of all, it obviously did not apply to the Africans whom they enslaved in New Amsterdam, starting probably in 1627, a year after the city was founded. And as you say, it did not, they viewed the native people entirely differently. Now, at the same time, I have to kind of temper that, because they originally settled in order to do business with the native people. They went there primarily for the fur trade, and they themselves were not going to go and trap beavers and other animals. They relied on the native people to do that and to trade with them. And from the native perspective, they valued European manufactured goods. So there was something in it for them, too. And for a period of time throughout the whole lifetime of this Dutch colony, that works pretty well. But then there are significant times when it breaks down and violence erupts. So it's a complicated story.
And do you think the idea that the Dutch had of tolerance was as progressive as we often think? It applied to some, but not necessarily to everyone.
Well, it was what it was at the time. It essentially applied to other white European Christians. In a very limited way, it applied to Jews, and there were instances where there was a small Jewish population in New Amsterdam, and Peter Stuyvesant, the Dutch leader, he himself, I think, would have preferred the prevailing intolerance, the intolerance that prevailed elsewhere in Europe, because it would have made his colony more cohesive. I think he himself was of that mind. And so he tries to bar Jews from settling, but they appeal over his head to the home country, and the home country says they have a point. We have this policy of religious toleration. So you have to read between the lines. You have to kind of piece out what exactly this was. But I do think it was a step forward for humanity.
Do you see echoes of the divides, the debates that were taking place in the 17th century in the United States today?
Well, the origins, you know, these origin stories always have kernels in them. It's sort of like the genetic material. So even though it's, you know, we're hundreds of years removed and our cities look nothing like the way they looked, there is some of that elemental character there. And in this story in particular, Richard Nichols, sailing for the English, actually had two missions. One was to take control of this Dutch colony. His second mission was with regards to New England. Now, New England was, these were English colonies, but they were also an enemy of sorts because they were settled by the Puritans. The Puritans were, throughout much of the 17th century, English society was bitterly divided, and the English Civil War was one result between the Puritans, who were, to my mind, religious extremists, and what are normally termed the Royalists, because they were sort of under the banner of the monarchy. But I think a better term is something like the anti-Puritans. Everybody who did not want the Puritans to take over and institute a theocratic regime and outlaw Christmas and dancing and theater and things like that. So the Puritan camp is what founds these New England colonies, and the Puritans in England behead the king. His sons flee into exile in Europe. Then when they come back into power, they are now looking across and the Atlantic, and they see on the one hand this Dutch colony, which they envy and they want, and then they see these New England colonies, and they need to somehow corral them, get them to follow them. So that was the second part of Nichols' mission. He fails at that. The Puritans based in Boston are simply too powerful. They just rebuff him. And that sets up a dynamic, to answer your question, whereby in American history then, throughout the colonial period into right down to where we are now, you've got two ideological bases. One, New York, which is relatively globalist, pragmatic, business-oriented, and the other, which was originally headquartered in Boston, which was inward-looking, it was sort of America first, it was God gave us the right to this continent, and those two ideologies have been in competition ever since, and I think what we're seeing play out in American politics right now is a reflection of that.
And where does slavery fit into this story then? Because that just seems to complicate things even more. And you look at people like Dorothea Angola and some very interesting figures who were part of this early story.
Slavery was, as I say, a part of the Dutch colony. It was part of the English colonies. The story of slavery in New Netherland was not what we think of if we think of slavery, if we think back on slavery now. They were still inventing it, and they were trying to work out what it was and wasn't. They seemed to have taken some elements of indentured servitude. And I say that because there was a notion that enslaved people, after working for a number of years, could petition for their freedom as if they were indentured servants who had a contract for a number of years. And that is what happened. You mentioned Dorothea Angola, who I spend time with in the book. She came as an enslaved African, probably in 1627. She marries another African. They have children. Then they petition for their freedom and receive it. They get land, 6 acres of land. Her husband dies. She remarries. She has children. She has grandchildren. She becomes you know, you have to figure a person of some substance in Lower Manhattan, in New Amsterdam, and then in New York. So that, you know, what that means in terms of understanding, you know, the sort of clearing the mists and trying to understand what slavery was at the time, it's the complications are really interesting. And then as you move forward at, into the next generation, around into the 1700s, that's when English New York institutes slave codes. They institutionalize the notion of slavery, which says what the enslaved can do. It restricts them. Only no more than three Africans can congregate, or black people can congregate in an area. So then it starts to take on this character of this really official legalized institution.
Well, it's a brilliant new book that tells the extraordinary events that created New York and shaped America. It's called Taking Manhattan. It's published in hardback by W.W. Norton & Company. The author, Russell Shorto. And Russell, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. The world is full of runes, and each of these runes has a different history, but they share a single truth. They're all places where one day the future ended. Well, a brilliant new book, Fall of Civilizations, based on the critically acclaimed podcast, takes a clear eye on humanity's past mistakes and whether we are doomed to repeat them. The book, as I say, Fall of Civilizations, Stories of Greatness and Decline. It's published in paperback by Duckworth. The author is Paul Cooper. And Paul, you're very welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Well, tell me about your approach, this idea of exploring, I suppose, how great civilizations rose to power, what life was like, but also crucially, what it was like when they fell.
That's right. Yeah, I began my show in 2019 with the idea of looking at how some of the world's most amazing ruined structures came to be the way they are. I've always been fascinated with the figure of the ruin, how we've always been drawn to them, how they have a sense of romance, but also contain a powerful warning about the future. Whenever people have wandered through ruined sites, they've always not only wondered, you know, what people's lives were like when they walked along these ruined halls, but also, will my house, my street, my city one day look the same? For me, I begin every episode of my show and every chapter of my book with a ruin and try to recount the story of the first person who stumbled across it and wrote an account of that. I show what it looked like, the crumbling temple falling into the sands, the temple covered in vines and creepers. But then I ask, how did this ruin get here? Every ruined place is a place of rupture, a place where one day things were completely one way and then that way of life came to an end. For me, those are the most fascinating stories.
And you leave out the ones that survive just by transitioning into a different form. You're really looking for the ones that collapse.
That's right. For me, I'm not really interested in stories of the disintegration of empires, you know, of which there are countless throughout history. What I want to look at is stories of social collapse, the disintegration of the social fabric. So I'm interested in stories where cities were abandoned, where whole tracts of land were depopulated. Those, for me, are the stories of historical apocalypse that have always drawn me.
And you begin by recounting how you visited Iraq in 2016 and went to one of the palaces that had belonged to Saddam Hussein. And apparently he only visited it once after constructing it, but the cook still had to prepare the meal for him every night just in case he did turn up.
That's right. That's the story. This is the palace of Saddam Hussein that sits on an artificial hill outside the town of Hilla, which is about 100 kilometers south of Baghdad on the River Tigris. And it's a fascinating site today because, you know, you can climb up to walk around this palace. There's no security. It's completely open to the public now. All the glass has been blown out of the windows. There's graffiti scrawled on the walls. There's local children playing football in the cavernous space of the entrance hall. But what's amazing is that you can wander out onto the balcony of his main bedroom and see why that palace was built there. Because stretched out in front of you, you can see the expanse of the ruins of the city of Babylon, a city that flourished in the millenniums before Christ, that was flourishing for 2,000 years before Alexander the Great captured it, a city that exists in the Bible. And Saddam Hussein built his palace here because he wanted to encourage comparisons between his regime and the great kings of Mesopotamia, like Nebuchadnezzar. today, those two ruins now sit next to each other, forming a fascinating comment on the way that history is constantly being written and rewritten, the way ruins pile on top of ruins, and the great debris of history is constantly building up.
And you want the book to be a call to action, because there is an important lesson here that we can't take anything for granted, and that greed and other forces can really destroy things that we thought were solid and secure.
Yeah, we look at the Maya, the Inca, the Aztec empires in the New World. We look at the Songhai Empire in West Africa, Carthage and Byzantium, as well as looking at Roman Britain and Easter Island. And in all these stories, I think they share some common themes. For one thing, stories of environmental change are often key in the tale of collapse. Many of these societies kept their populations in states of staggering inequality. Some collapsed because the interconnected systems of trade and exchange they were a part of disintegrated. We also see excessively bellicose or aggressive treatment of empires' neighbors sometimes caused those neighbors to unite against them and ultimately destroy them. So I think there are lessons to be drawn from the history of these various stories of collapse. Disintegration has been as much a part of the human story as any exalted epic or grand monument. That throughout history, people have kept hope alive in the future, that they've kept having children, that they have kept writing poetry. And I always try to include these snippets of poetry that give you a sense of what it felt like to live through these times of historic collapse.
So it's not a case of abandoning all hope, all ye who enter, but trying to find a way of building a new hope or finding a new hope.
I think that's the thing. My stories are never just the story of collapse, but also of what happens next. I like to show stories of people surviving through resilience and determination through the ruins, and also the green shoots of a new society that we always see rising like out of the ashes of a forest fire. Humans are such a resilient species that no matter how terrible the collapse is, we always find a way to keep going.
The Sumerians 6,000 years ago really were an extraordinary civilization, and they seem to have been prone to falling for, you know, strange ideas and quirks and myths that perhaps weren't going to be very helpful for them.
Yeah, that's right. I have a great soft spot in my heart for the Mesopotamian empires. We look at the Sumerians in the book and also the Assyrians, both of whom flourished in the valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. The Sumerians, 4,000 to 2,000 years ago. The Sumerians from 4,000 to 2,000 BC, and the Assyrians in the second and first millenniums BC. Now, these cultures flourished partly because of their fastidious record-keeping. We know so much about them because, unlike some other cultures that wrote on paper or other more ephemeral materials, the Sumerians and Assyrians wrote using clay tablets, which they formed using the simple technology of river clay picked up from the ground around them and reeds that were growing on the sides of the rivers. Now, these clay tablets contained everything from the contracts over sales of slaves to the yields of various barley and wheat crops, production of beer factories, and honestly, these were the equivalents of ancient emails. The people who wrote them didn't think they were very important. But due to the durability of clay, we now have an immense amount of data that shows us the daily lives of these people who lived, in some cases, 6,000 years ago. In this sense, we get this unprecedented view into these people's lives. And as you say, their myth. We have marvelous stories of the great flood that drowned the world, and we can see the evolution of that story as it passed to the Babylonians who followed after, and from there to the Hebrew poets who wrote the book of Genesis. So in some sense, this is the oldest continually told story.
And we also see the quirks and the failures of leaders in these various civilizations. And I'm thinking of the ruler of Delhi in the 16th century. And that was a huge civilization that extended, you know, across India. But when things went wrong there and they were attacked, he ends up throwing gold and jewels from a pile on his feet to try and persuade people to fight the enemy.
That's right, yes. This is the Raja, or king, Rama Raya, who is the last king of the South Indian state of Vijayanagara. Now, he is a character who it's particularly easy to have contempt for. He's that particular brand of malice combined with incompetence that many listeners might find familiar in certain in characters currently populating current events. But he starts a foolhardy war that results in all of the Empire's enemies uniting against it. All of them combined overpower its forces and sweep into the city. And instead of holding by some gold in order to pay the ransom that was usually given out to prevent a sacking of the city, his brothers flee the city with all the gold, leaving its citizens behind to be slaughtered and the city to be burned. Today, the ruins of the city of Vijayanagara are still standing in the town of Hampi in Karnataka in South India, and you can visit them today. They're one of the most amazing ruin sites in the world.
And you also include modern cities in it, and you also explore how cities can decline, cities can fall into ruin, even in the modern age, looking at a city, for example, like Detroit.
I'm a historian, but I couldn't resist the sense of looking into the future and asking what will it look like when our society collapses. The truth is that a society like modern industrial capitalism has never existed in the past, so we can't really say for sure what it would look like when it came apart. But we can guess based on some examples of abandoned sites we have seen around the world, like, as you mentioned, Detroit, like the city of Varosha in Cyprus, places where the society that maintains the high-technology modern city receded for some reason and left our leafy suburbs or our towering skyscrapers to decay. We can imagine that if our society does face a collapse, whether caused by environmental chaos or economic disintegration, that the forces that keep our modern cities sustained may no longer themselves be sustainable. I imagine the city of London, as it might look 100 years after a great collapse, as the Thames barrier fails and the streets become flooded. I try to ask how people of the future will also remember us. Will they look back on us and tell stories about our great towers that fell because of our pride, or even a great flood that came and drowned our world? The sad truth is that because in our modern digital age, so much of our writing is contained only in servers and hard drives, that much of what we've recorded about our lives will simply vanish, like the palm leaf paper of the Khmer or the quipu rope knots of the Inca. It may be that the people who follow after our society will end up knowing less about us than they do about the Sumerians and Assyrians, who had the good sense to write on clay.
If you could visit, go back in time and visit one of these fallen civilizations at its height, which one would you choose and why?
That's a great question, but such a difficult decision. I think it would be amazing to see the city of Angkor in its golden age in Cambodia. The towering temples, the elephants wandering the streets, the parade of kings. That would be one of my top choices. But also it would be amazing to see the cities of the Inca in their golden age, the golden temples of the Coricancha. Visit Machu Picchu while people are still farming on its terraces.
Do you think the people in these civilizations realized what was happening when things were going wrong, or did they just slowly kind of maybe sleepwalk through it until it was too late to avert what was happening?
I think the story of each collapse is different, and some happen as a kind of slow decline over centuries. One example of that would be the Byzantine Empire, which is the successor state of the Eastern Roman Empire. Rome in the East never really falls, but transitions into this medieval state, which we now call Byzantium. And over centuries, due to civil wars, due to economic mismanagement, due to powerful nearby rivals emerging, this state was slowly winnowed away until it was only the city of Constantinople and the area immediately around it, which was finally besieged and conquered. This was a decline that took centuries to unfold. But other times it can really be a thunderclap. For instance, the Assyrian Empire goes through its golden age really only decades before it begins its disintegration. Some of the most marvelous artifacts from that empire are carved only 30 years before it collapses. These are the lion hunt carvings of King Ashurbanipal, which you can now see in the British Museum. But after that king dies, there's a period of a few years where you have various weak kings, and then the entire empire's enemies unite against it. The Assyrians had always treated their neighbors with extreme cruelty and aggression, putting one down after the other and ensuring that they could never form a united front. But finally, the Medes, the Babylonians, everyone whom the Assyrians had trampled over the centuries, joined together, swept into the Tigris-Euphrates Valley and burned each of the Assyrian cities one by one.
It's called Fall of Civilizations, Stories of Greatness and Decline, published in paperback by Duckworth. And Paul is, of course, the host of that brilliant podcast series, Fall of Civilizations. And there's a YouTube video series as well. Paul, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. Mary McSweeney was one of the most single-minded anti-treaty women, leading Eamon de Valera to describe her as incorrigible. Rather than just dismiss McSweeney as one-dimensional in her opposition to the treaty and in her continued political intractability, a new biography seeks to place her political life within the centre of the turn of the 20th century Republican narrative and understand why she was increasingly viewed as a virago. The book is called Mary McSweeney. It's published in paperback by UCD Press. The author is Leanne Lane. And Leanne, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you, Patrick.
Can we begin with why you felt it was important to write a new biography of Mary McSweeney now?
Well, the last biography is over 40 years old and it relies very heavily just on the McSweeney papers in UCD archives. And it also is just really a narrative of what she did and what she said. I felt it was necessary to think about, you know, why she actually took certain stances she did. Your history is increasingly about emotions. Emotional responses often dictate kind of action responses. So I wanted to kind of investigate why she became this cipher for republicanism. She was, at the end of the day, a human being. And when I started to dig into not just the McSweeney papers in UCD archives, but other papers in the National Library or even material in the MSPC, it's quite clear that she was somebody who had suffered an extreme trauma. And rather than just say that her brother died on hunger strike, a very high profile hunger strike in Brixton in 1920, I tried to think about, well, what would she have felt watching her beloved brother die over that long protracted time period? And I looked at the medical notes, for example, Terence's medical notes, and it's very, very clear that the family were suffering extreme distress. And if you watch a beloved member of your family die in those conditions, then you are going to be either suffering from the more traditional trauma, you know, a breakdown, or in the case of Mary McSweeney, you are galvanised into extreme political action. And the medical notes are so interesting. You know, there's a lot of talk after the death of Terence that he suffered a good death. But the reality of the medical notes is that he was sullen, he was surly. That's what the doctors described him as, you know, on a typical day. And obviously, if you're sick, if you're dying, that's how you're experiencing it. And for his family to witness that, for them to be repeatedly told to encourage him to take food when they believe in his sacrifice, that's very, very distressing and very, very traumatic. And her response to that was to ensure that that for which her brother had died would be achieved, a republic with no concessions.
And do you think his death, the death of Terence McSweeney, shaped her later political stances, that she saw herself as carrying on his sacrifice?
I think to a point, but I think it's important not to deny her own autonomy. She was extremely politically active in her own right. You know, during the treaty debates, one of the reporters actually stated that it's difficult to decide who was the disciple and who was actually the student, Mary or Terence. She was somebody who, in the period before the hunger strike, was heavily involved in advanced nationalist politics in Cork, albeit maybe in a kind of a traditional kind of gendered way. Cork didn't, of course, rise in 1916, so that didn't allow her the opportunities that female activists in Dublin, say, had to do more kind of advanced tasks, dispatch carrying, etc. But she was involved in Cumann na mBan. She set up Cumann na mBan in Cork in June 1914. She's heavily involved in prisoner aid during the War of Independence. not just in Ireland, but also visiting prisoners in the immediate aftermath of 1916. So she herself was somebody who genuinely believed in advanced nationalism. But I think what Terence's death did was to deny her any opportunity in her own mind to think about something other than the Republic. So while De Valera, for example, during the Civil War, was kind of inching towards getting out of that kind of cul-de-sac that he found himself in, Mary was absolutely writing repeatedly to him saying, you can't compromise, you can't compromise. So she was denied, I think, that mental space to think about anything other than a republic that De Valera did have.
So let's talk then about the treaty and that political compromise and why she opposed it. And was it because she saw this as a betrayal of the republic that so many had suffered for?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she spoke for 2 hours, 35 minutes longer than the five plenipotentiaries together. She spoke to sneers from Arthur Griffith, but she absolutely saw it as a betrayal. She had been in America since December 1920, initially speaking to the Commission on Conditions in Ireland, the American Commission on Conditions in Ireland. And then she had done a very grueling tour of America, fundraising for the bond drive. And she came back, as she said, to Ireland, absolutely rife with kind of rumours of compromise. And in the kind of lead up to the treaty, she was writing to De Valera asking him for assurances that there wouldn't be compromise. So anything other than a pure republic, a 32-county republic, was something that she couldn't countenance.
What was her relationship with Eamon de Valera like? They seemed to have been surprisingly close, but then perhaps drifted as time went on.
I think they were very close. I think he respected her. I think the evidence for that is that he conducted what I would suggest is quite an intimate political correspondence with her during the Civil War, where he voiced his own concerns at being, you know, maybe on a side that he didn't intend to end up on, not a parliamentary side outside the Dáil. He said to her at one point, I'm writing you a letter that I've never written to anybody else again. The fact that he repeatedly wrote to her, I think does suggest that he respected her. She also was quite open with him. She repeatedly said to him, please don't be cross with me if I say this to you. So there was, I think, a kind of a bedrock of respect between the two. I think when it starts then to kind of fracture is, of course, when he wants to get out of Sinn Féin beginning in 1925. And he actually breaks in 1926. And at that point, he's more irascible in his correspondence with her. But when she died, he wanted to be represented the funeral, and he wouldn't permit that. But I think they genuinely respect each other. And I think it is important to actually stress that, given that De Valera gets this rap that he doesn't respect women. But, you know, he wrote very, very long correspondence with her over a series of years.
Yeah, she opposed the foundation of Fianna Fáil in 1926 and saw it as a legitimisation of partition and compromise and a betrayal of Republican principles. So she saw them re-entering the Dáil the year after as all of this as part of some big betrayal.
Absolutely. But at the same time, she was very quick to say that it wasn't as bad as they weren't as bad as Cumann na Gaelhiel. And she did talk, or at least kind of was somewhat open to a Republican front at the next election. I mean, it went nowhere really, but she was absolutely adamant that Sinn Féin deputies, the members of the Fortune Party, or Sinn Féin members, wouldn't actually excoriate Fianna Fáil to allow them maybe naively a route back into Sinn Féin.
The book is brilliant on the gender issues, the way Mary McSweeney was vilified, the way the women who opposed the treaty were vilified, and they were abused and attacked in ways that their male contemporaries who also opposed the treaty weren't.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, it goes to the gender roles at the time. You know, women were not supposed to be out of the home. They were supposed to be wife and married mother. And if they were, for example, you know, obviously the revolutionary period opened up a space where women could engage in some form of political activism, but it was supposed to be quite gendered. And Mary McSweeney was so vocal that she was absolutely excoriated. She was described as a Cork virago. The Belfast Newsletter described her as having blood dripping from her fangs. She was also used to try to emasculate De Valera. So when De Valera was in America fundraising for what would become the Irish Press, Cumann na Gaelhiel deputies talked about De Valera having run away from Mary McSweeney, that they'd put De Valera up a tree where Mary McSweeney couldn't get her, that Mary McSweeney had De Valera in her vanity bag. She was, of course, a single, unmarried woman, an unmarried woman with no children. So she was very much undermining or transgressing gender roles. There were people, who, certainly during the Civil War and the anti-Treaty-side men, who were just as vicious, as uncompromising, as bloodthirsty as she was made out to be. But they weren't treated in the same way in the press.
No, she's accused of wanting to be the Queen of Ireland.
Yes, that's what Cosgrave accused her, yes. Off with their heads, she is accused of saying to everybody.
And it wasn't just, though, the people at the time who attacked them in that way. I remember studying them in college and studying the treaty in college. And it was the same way in the accounts in the books, that they were extremists and they were emotional. And it was because of what had happened to their family members that was blinding them. Mm-hmm. And it was removing any kind of agency from them and really portraying them as these harsh extremists.
Yeah, absolutely. But the interesting thing is that Mary never mentioned Terence once in her 2 hours, 35 minutes speech. No, she did allude to him, but she never mentioned him in English, for example, never had no family members. She made that very clear when she gave her anti-treaty speech. She was not talking about any dead brothers or husbands or fathers. But yeah, it continued on, I think. I mean, certainly when I was in college, we didn't even do women's history.
And it's also interesting the way she's maybe sometimes just remembered as this angry woman, as just the sister of Terence, and not a formidable figure in Sinn Féin in her own right, not someone who was a TD and a public speaker and, you know, hugely successful on her American tour, that this is a very significant political figure in her own right.
Absolutely. She was reduced to the cipher, but you know, what I've tried to do in the biography is kind of, you know, present a more holistic view of her life. She was, first of all, a beloved sister. And I think, you know, that's really important to try to understand her. I talk about the McSweeney family as a Republican family unit, and they all stood together. They all loved each other dearly. She was somebody who established a really, really interesting school for girls, first lay Catholic school for girls in Cork, St. Edith's, when she was sacked from St. Angela's after the 1916 rebellion. She was somebody who was loved by her friends, you know, loved by somebody like Moira Comfort. Kathleen Lynn was very respectful of her. As we've talked about, De Valera did respect her for a time, but I think it's after De Valera establishes Fianna Fáil and the Fortune Féin party just kind of engages in kind of acrimonious wrangles and kind of talk about regulations and rules. And then, of course, she breaks from Cumann na mBan, you know, so she becomes politically very isolated. At the same time, her own family life is actually, in the last decade of her life, quite a family life is very enjoyable for her. That's maybe the wrong way of putting it, but it's a happy time for her because, of course, she does go to Germany and take Terence's daughter Maura Óg back to Cork to live with her and Annie. It's the subject of a high court case. Maura Óg, I think, always said that this was the right decision for her, but Muriel, of course, didn't speak to the family after that. But Mary's personal life was very happy in the last decade of her life, at the same time as her political life became very narrow.
And I was very impressed with her speeches on her American tours, and a big speech she gave in Texas that you write about, where she wasn't just appealing to the hyphenated Americans, the Irish Americans. She wanted to appeal to the 100% Americans. Yeah, yeah. And she was making references to Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and Daniel Webster, and she was trying to make an appeal for Ireland that would resonate with all Americans.
Yes, I mean, that was so interesting when she went over to the commission or to speak at the commission, at the American Commission on Conditions in Ireland. I think she really was kind of just seen as Muriel's sister-in-law. And the papers were all about Muriel that December 1920. And then Mary began to speak and everybody was absolutely in awe because she understood American history so well. And she tried to repeatedly make the connections between, you know, American Revolution and what was happening in Ireland. And that was something that she repeated in many, many speeches across America, her desire to appeal to all Americans. This was a very grueling time for her as she, you know, traveled back and forth. And her letters to Harry Boland are quite interesting on a human level as well. You know, she's trying to encourage him to give her help and give support financially, etc. But yes, she's repeatedly trying to not just appeal to Irish Americans, but to Americans as a whole.
Was she unhappy in her later years because she was politically isolated? She, you know, had sparred publicly with Fianna Fáil. You know, Sinn Féin was becoming increasingly marginal. Was she disappointed and disillusioned with the way things went?
I think politically, of course, yes. You know, for example, St. Edith's School, she was always in difficulties because she refused to put it under the auspices of the Department of Education because she didn't recognise Free State. Some of the files in the MSPC from Cork, Women Looking for Pensions, had named her as a referee, but she refused to even tell them that she wouldn't write a reference. So she absolutely refused to engage with the Free State to the point of excoriating, you know, people like Art O'Connor for agreeing to take up a position as, you know, in the legal profession. But I think this is what I've tried to do, to see her on a more holistic level. She loved her school. She loved her life in Cork. She was somebody who was maybe very kind of strident, but underneath that was somebody who, you know, was very principled and passionate. And I think Maura Ogue also coming to Cork to live with her in the 1930s was a meant that that decade on a personal level was very, very happy. And Maura Ogue certainly was very happy. There's some lovely photographs of the family, say, holidaying in Dunqueen and Kerry. Two of her two sisters who became nuns came over, and there's a photograph of Annie herself and the two sisters. She absolutely loved Maura Ogue, and she really put herself to doing everything she could to ensure that she had a happy life and was fully educated as well.
And of course, we sometimes forget that Mary McSweeney was a hunger striker as well, and during the Civil War made a very powerful protest. And, you know, how much of an impact did that make? Because it definitely seems to have led to, you know, protests about her detention, and it seems to have resonated with the public.
Yes, so she was in prison four times during the Civil War, twice briefly, and then for two long periods, November 1922 in Mountjoy and April 1923 in Kilmaino. And she went on two high-profile hunger strikes. I think the November one was more high-profile. And Cosgrave is really, it's in difficulties because he's getting all these postcards and letters. You cannot let the sister of Terence McSweeney die. Now, there are some people writing to him and saying, like, you know, she's just a mad suffragette, you know, just let her die. But, you know, this would have been really probably an own goal for Cosgrave if she did die. And at one point, Annie McSweeney comes up from Cork to Mountjoy to seek entry to visit Mary, and she's denied. And she's on hunger strike outside Mountjoy and Mary's inside, and there's protests across Ireland. So it was a very difficult one for Cosgrave, and she's quietly released at the end of November. Her hunger strike in April was maybe less high profile, maybe a sign that the public was kind of accepting that the Free State was established. It was a very difficult for her on an emotional level as well, because she had witnessed what had happened to Terence. So when Terence was dying on hunger strike, nobody really understood, you know, how the body would respond to that prolonged hunger strike. But Mary was able to talk about, say, to Dorothy McArdle, at this point now neuralgia will hit in, at this point certain symptoms will occur. So knowing what she was facing and willing to die, that was a very brave decision, and it was a mark of her principle. Now, people said that she could have done nothing else. Daniel Corky said she couldn't have done anything other than, you know, continue the sacrifice of Terence when she herself was imprisoned.
So how do you think we should remember her in the 21st century?
I think as a human being, as somebody who was much more than just an intractable opponent of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, as somebody who was a family member, who was very much influenced by her love for her family. And I think that's something that really, really came out for me. The family operated as a unit. When Sean was, for example, imprisoned in Canada in 1918, you know, she did the exact same thing as she did when Terence was imprisoned at various points in his life, from January 1916 to his death in 1920, writing, trying to seek help for him, trying to understand around where he was, trying to engage with the prison authorities. So as a sister, a beloved sister, as somebody who was principled, as somebody who was more than just an intractable woman, somebody who set up a really, really progressive school for girls. As Roy Foster says about that school, St. Edith's, it wasn't just, parents sending their children to that school because there was a problem in school, but parents sending their children to that school because it was a good school.
Okay, well, it's a brilliant new study of a significant figure in Irish history and a much misrepresented and marginalised voice in early 20th century Irish politics. The book is called Mary McSweeney. It's published by UCD Press. The author, Leanne Lane. And Leanne, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Patrick.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.